Okay, I think we can get started. All right, Erev Tov, everybody. Hope it's a pleasure to welcome a Torontonian who's moved to the United States, at least for now. Sophia Freudenstein, who grew up in Toronto, a student at CHAT, where I have the pleasure of teaching, a graduate of University of Toronto with, I think, a double major, if I'm not mistaken, in philosophy and Jewish studies. She is currently in her final year of, I believe, Yeshivat Maharat. Is also in Yeshivat Risha and also doing a degree at Bernard Revel Graduate School. You worked at Camp Stone, I think, no? Director of Chinuch. I don't know what I missed, but that's a pretty good introduction. So, Vakasha, Sophia, it's all yours.
Great. Thank you so much, Rabbi Jay. It's an honor to be here with all of you tonight. And we're going to learn a little bit about Parshat Vayera. Let me just try and share my screen and make sure that goes okay. Okay. Let's see. Sorry, one second. Okay. I think this should work. Okay, great. It's loading. Amazing. Okay, so there is a source sheet, I believe, that Rabbi Jay might have if people want, but we're going to have the sources here in front of us, so I think we'll be fine. Before I begin, I just want to start with a quick kavanah that you might recognize from our Friday night davening. That phrase that comes from the Yerushalmi, Talmidei Chachamim Marbim Shalom Ba'olam, the idea that when we learn Torah together, it helps increase peace in the world. So we're going to be learning a lot about the technicalities of halacha and the parsha today, but hopefully by all of us learning together, we can all have the kavanah to be thinking about a more peaceful world speedily in our days. Okay, and with that note, we're going to learn about Parshat Vayera. We're going to start off with a story from the destruction of Sodom that is in this week's parsha. The parsha begins with Avraham being in the tent and the angels coming to visit him, and they promise that he's going to have a son eventually, but they also warn him about the destruction of Sodom and Amorah. Avraham protests with God and is concerned that there aren't tzaddikim, there are righteous people in the city that might need to be saved. Ultimately, it is determined that the only person or family worth saving is Avraham's nephew Lot, and there are angels that come to try and save him and his family. And we're going to be picking up from the middle of the story. What we're going to be reading is what happens when Lot leaves Sodom and Amorah, what that looks like, and then what happens to his family. And that will be the setup for where I want to take the shiur. Before we get to that also, I would love to say that usually in a shiur, I would love for it to be back and forth. I know that's not the usual style of the Torah in Motion shiur, but if you have any comments or questions, feel free to leave them in the chat and hopefully I will catch up to them as we go along. Okay, so our first source here is from the middle of that story in Bereishit. And it says, Vayit Mahama Vayachaziku Anashim Biyado Uviyad Ishto Uviyad Shtei Venotav Bechemlat Adonai Alav Vayotzie Uhu Vayanichuhu Michutz La'ir. So Lot and his family have left. However, he tarries. He is delayed. One can imagine maybe the emotional fraughtness of even when it's time to go, that this is where his home was and where he had built up his family, and it was probably difficult for him to totally leave. The Midrash likes picking up on that, saying maybe Lot also was delaying because he wasn't so sure he was ready to separate himself from the evil people of Sodom, and it was also a representation of that kind of back and forth on in a moral sense. But then the people, it says, but here we understand it to be angels, take him by force and his family to make sure that they are saved, and they take him outside of the city. And so when they brought them outside, one of the angels says, flee, run for your life, don't look behind you, and make sure not to stand on the plain, run away to the hills unless lest you get swept up in the destruction. Very interesting that they tell them not to turn away. I guess probably if we're saying before what Sodom represents, if it represents this place of evil and lack of morality, not wanting to look there also is representation of finally leaving that state. Okay. But Lot says to them, oh no. הנה נא מצא עבדך חן בעיניך ותגדל חסדך אשר עשית עמדי להחיות את נפשי ואנוכי לא אוכל למלא טהרה פן תדבקני הרעה ומתי. The Lord says, oh no, you've been so gracious to me and shown me so much kindness to save me, but I can't flee. I might die in the process as well. Hinena ha'ir hazot krova lanu shama v'hi mitzar imalatana shama. Halo mitzar hi v'tchi nafshi. Maybe I should run away to this other city close by, and I will be safe and I will be able to stay alive. V'yomar lev hinena sati fanecha gam l'davar hazeh l'vilti afki et ha'ir asher dibarta. And they say, okay, fine. I will make sure not to destroy this town. Maher himalei shama ki lo uchal lasot davar ad boacha shama al kein kara shema yir tzohar. Go there quickly because God is not going to destroy Sodom until you're safely out of the way, and then it becomes the name Tzohar because before if we saw in the previous verse mitzar that it's a place that is little or narrow and restricted. Okay. Really, we're trying to get to the end of this summary. That's like where we're going to pick up this year, but we have all this background. Hashemesh yetza ala aretz velot ba tzohara. Okay, the sun passes by, lot gets to tzohar. Baranahim tir al stone ba'al mora gafrit va'esh me'et adonai min hashemayim. And then because lot was now safe in tzohar, God rains down upon stone and amora. What's the translation of gafrit v'melach here? We have... sulfurous fire. That will be important for what coming up. So, like, what kind of element is being used here from God? And that destroyed all of the cities and the plain and everyone who was living there and also any living plants or vegetation. And the last detail, we are focusing so much on Lot, even though we were talking about his family, is that if you remember all the way at the beginning of this, that the angels had warned Lot to not turn back because we don't know yet why exactly, but Lot's wife turns back and she turns into a pillar of salt. You might be familiar with this story maybe if you were growing up in day school. It's a great dramatic story when talking about Parshat Vayera. And also there's a lot of, there's like a fun cultural aspect in Israel that when you go to the Dead Sea, there's an understanding that the sulfur salt of the Dead Sea is supposed to be what Lot's wife is made out of. Okay, so that's the background we have here, is we know that Sodom and Amorah get destroyed, Lot and his family run away. Ultimately, Lot's wife does not make it because she turns and she back and she turns into a pillar of salt. That seems like a fun dramatic story based off of what we just said, but what I want to explore in the Shiur today is how this kind of dramatic story that feels fantastical, it feels like something you would read about in a fantasy book, actually becomes the basis for a halakha that is practiced by some people even today. And that's what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about Mayim Achronim. So Mayim Achronim, maybe some people here know it as Negelwasser. This is a ritual that people do around the time of benching, at the end of a meal. Where around Shira Malot time, there'll be a little cup that gets passed around, a little bowl, and usually a little cup that's smaller than a typical Netilat Yadayim washing cup because it doesn't have the same halachic requirements. It'll get passed around, and people will pour a little bit on their fingers and move it around.
Sorry to interrupt you. Negelwasser is the water that you put in the morning, first thing when you get up. That's the Negelwasser.
From my understanding, when the Kmuz Ivan, that's all that the Mayim Achronim have also been called Negelwasser, but it's very possible that's correct. I know about it colloquially in my own community, but I'm sure that it's another example of ritual hand washing. So that makes sense. Mayim Achronim, which is what we're going to be focusing on, this is what happens at this stage of the meal, at the end of the meal, leading up to Birkan HaMazon. And I have here from the Shulchan Aruch that articulates that doing Mayim Achronim is mandatory. It is a chovah. I know as much as I just said some communities do that, in my family and also in my synagogue, my Orthodox synagogue, we don't do this. And there's a range of opinions why not, which we'll see coming up. And ultimately, this halacha has a connection to the parsha and what we just read about Lot's wife turning into salt. And we're going to see how that goes in the shir. We're going to look at different sources about where this concern for Mayim Achronim comes from, why it's mandatory to do, see how it's connected to our Parsha. And then hopefully when we have a better understanding of how Mayim Achronim works, that can help us understand a little bit more about why Lot's wife turned into salt, what it represents, and what it can teach us about our own experiences at the table, but also at the lessons that we learn from it can be applicable to us today. So that is the framing for our shir as we go. Okay. So let's look at some sources that talk about the source of Ma'an Achronim being a concern for danger, as we just saw that there's something mandatory about it. It says in Masechet Chulin, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, B'rei de Rabbi Chia, Mipnei Ma'an Ru Ma'im Achronim Chova, Shemelch Stomit Yesh Shemesameh Ta'inayim. So we have here Rabbi Yehuda, son of Rabbi Chia, asks, why do we say that Ma'im Achronim is necessary to do after a meal? Is because sodomite salt, melach stomit, this could be what we were saying about Lot's wife, right? She is salt that is from stone. It also could have been connected to the gafrit that we saw, the sulfurous, the sulfur that was thrown onto the city in destruction by God. The concern is that that might be present, and if you were to touch it and then to touch your eyes, that it would blind you. So this is a medical understanding, not necessarily one that is like deeply moralistic, but that sometimes the Gemara also just has science or their conception of science. And this is another example of that. And an example that is a lived experience of keeping kosher is that there also is a scientific understanding at the time of the Gemara to not have fish and meat at the same meal. And so we don't have it completely separated in the same way that we would meat and milk, but the people like will take a different cutlery or wipe their cutlery and that'll be sufficient. That is understood to be done by halakhically observant people, but it's for a scientific reason of the past. And that seems to be the kind of category that Ma'im Achronim is in as well, that we are concerned about melach stomit getting in people's eyes and blinding them. What's interesting, though, is that the choice of blindness being the concern is that it could be scientific, but there's something really interesting when thinking back to our Parsha and also Parshiot previously about the role of eyesight when it comes to stom. So an example from our Parsha right before the passage we just read, when the people of stom come to Lot's home to try and attack the angels or guests, and Lot tries fighting them back, in order to distract the people of stom so that Lot's family can run away, it says, "Ve'et anashim asher petach habayit hiku basan berim mikaton va'gadol ve'u limtso hapatach." That the people who were trying to enter and break into Lot's house, that God then sent blinding light so that anyone who was there, the young people and the old people, could not figure out the passageway. So here we see like an actual example of blindness being used in the story, that these people who are trying to do evil things are blinded in order to make sure that they don't get to Lot and his family. That's the example of just blindness and the concern of blindness affecting people. But now we have also then the metaphorical blindness and the sense of stone being a place that is not able to see what is moral and what is good. We see here in, this is from Parsha Lech Lecha from last week, that when Lot decides to live in Sodom as opposed to live with Avraham in Eretz Canaan, it says, Vaisa Lot et einav, Vayar et kol kikar hayarden, ki hula mashke, lifnei shichet Adonai et Sodom bet Amora, kigan Adonai ke Eretz Mitzrayim boacha soar. That when Lot is looking and seeing what land he wants to be his, Lot lifted up his eyes and saw the Jordan Valley, and saw that it was very there was a lot of vegetation. It was very luscious, and that area is where Sodom and Amorah was, and it was clearly before the destruction of Sodom and Amorah, because as we saw, it wasn't such a great place to grow things when it was covered in sulfur. And when Lot saw it, it was as if Lot saw the garden of God, almost kind of like Gan Eden, right? From the passageway of Tzoar. So he looks at Sodom v'Amorah. He sees that it's absolutely beautiful. He sees that it's going to be helpful for his crops and his flock. He says, great, I want to live there. And on a technical level, that's a great idea. However, we understand that Sodom v'Amorah is a place that is not moral. And so even though it might look and be alluring to live there, it's actually not the right place to live. So there is an example of metaphorical blindness in a sense that Lot is using his eyes to make the decision, but that's not the right way he should be making this decision. He should be thinking, what kind of people does he want to be surrounding himself with? So we see both an example from before of literal blindness that appears in the story about Lot and his family running away. There, it's actually there to help them. But we see now we see the example of Lot when deciding to live in Sodom and Gomorrah, an example of metaphorical or moral blindness, in that he is not able to properly see what is right for him. So when we think all the way back to this discussion that we saw in the Gemara, that doing Mayim Achronim is a helpful medical tool in order to make sure that Melech Sodomi does not get in our eyes, we wonder if also there's an additional valence of the metaphorical blindness or the connection to violence in this story, to blindness even in this in our parsha, that it's supposed to make us invoke back to. It's not merely just a scientific statement, but maybe there's something about Mayim Achronim that's supposed to make us remember what happened at Sodom and Gomorrah and make sure that we don't do the actions that were done there that led to their own destruction. Another, just to flesh out the idea of salt, this specific salt of Melech Sodomi being dangerous, I have here from the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah. Whenever bread is eaten with salt, it's necessary to wash one's hands afterward, right? We're so used to regular Netilat Yadayim before doing Hamotzi. But here we're talking about the Mayim Achronim, lest it contain sodomite salt or salt that resembles sodomite salt. And after eating, one inadvertently passes one's hands over one's eyes and blinds them. This, the possibility of acrid salt, is the reason why we are obligated to wash after eating. In an army camp, the soldiers are not obligated to wash before eating because they are involved in the war. However, obligated to wash afterwards because of the danger involved. So to really take the point home, the Rambam, taken all the way from Masechet Kritot, where they talk about this the first, or Masechet Eruvin, where they talk about this the first time, it says not only are you supposed to do this washing Mayim Achronim, in order to make sure that the salt, of sodomite salt does not get in your eyes. It's so important that even when you're in an army camp and when your resources are incredibly limited, you don't really want to spend, or waste water when it's not necessary. You don't therefore need to wash when you're eating. That seems like a really big but necessary shad adchak, time, in order to get rid of doing Netilat Yadayim. And yet you still need to do Mayim Achronim because there's a concern for your health. In another place, also to really take the point home that we are saying that it's a scientific point and not merely a it's not a mitzvah, is that the Rambam doesn't have a bracha that you would say with Mayim Achronim, right? We don't say Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melechem al netilat Mayim Yadayim Achronim. We don't say that. So, but we do say it for the first set, and that there's a lack of bracha here shows that it's really a scientific medical statement. However, as I said before, like for my own family or even my own synagogue, many people don't do it today. There are definitely communities that do. In the Sephardic community, it's still incredibly prevalent. However, Tosfot on Eruvin say, Mayim Achronim is mandatory. That was the line that we were talking about the context of the army. Nowadays, we don't practice doing Mayim Achronim since sodomite salt is not found among us. Additionally, we do not regularly dip our fingers into salt after eating. So what the Tosfot say is, okay, in the time of the Gemara, that was true. It was mandatory. But nowadays we don't because we don't have Melech Sodomim anymore. That's not a concern for us. And also the Tosfot point out a funny point, which is that this is also not how we eat. In Babylon, the way that they ate was there was a lot of like using their hands and using bread and wiping things up. And so therefore the concern would be is that if something got on your hands, then it could easily let If you were using, if you had salt on the table and then touched your hands, it could easily get into your eyes. Nowadays, it's not how we eat. A point that is really interesting that takes us even farther is Rav Yaakov Emden writes in the responsa that this is not applicable anymore, Mayim Achronim, because we have cutlery. And he starts talking about how we use cutlery. And so therefore, it's not a relevant concern anymore because we aren't using our hands to touch salt and then to touch our eyes. That's not how we eat anymore. Which is also just like kind of fun that like someone from 300 years ago is talking about cutlery. Like that's a fun example of when responsa can show us a little bit into the everyday experience of being a person during that time. So just as a quick summary of this section, we saw examples of how doing Mayim Achronim is a medical concern that we don't want salt to get in our eyes. It could be because we are concerned of blindness, but we also saw the potential valence of a moral blindness that comes with thinking about salt that comes from stone. But we also have this Tosfot that says, but maybe that's not even so relevant anymore if we're not concerned that Melech Sodomi exists in the world. So I think it would be meaningful to see other ways in which salt can be an interesting way to understand or like get different insights into the world and then think how can we apply that to our understanding of Mayim Achronim to make it feel relevant to us today. Does anyone have any questions or clarification before we move on?
I just want to say that it just occurred to me that some dvarim reflect, as you say, moral blindness, foreshadow the moral blindness of Yahya Sinwar.
Oh wow. Wow, I mean it's obviously a really awful and like painful example, but I guess it is beautiful in some ways to think that Torah can always feel relevant in any moment. That I guess is the silver lining to that connection. But yes, interesting literary parallel.
I have a question as well.
Sure.
Lot picks this place because it's like the Nile River, and then we never hear of him again being a shepherd. And shepherds don't usually live in cities. They live outside the cities as Abraham did. So I don't know if you can tie that into moral blindness or fooling himself that he was going because of the water, but he really was going because it was Las Vegas and he wanted to enjoy it.
Very nice. Right. Like he's claiming that it's for the purpose of helping his flock and helping vegetation, but also the shift into cities, which we see all the way back in Parsha Bereishit about what is the role of a city. Cities were created after death was introduced in the world from Cain. What does that say about the state of the moral world? The Las Vegas of the Middle East is a good framing of it. Amazing. Okay, let's move on to the next section. Okay. Now I want to explore a little bit more about salt as an element that preserves, and seeing how it preserves both in a physical sense. It is what we use in order to have pickles, in order to have beef jerky. And when you lived in a world without any kinds of refrigeration, it was incredibly necessary in order to preserve food. Maybe there's something meaningful that salt can teach us that make us think differently about mayim achronim and being concerned about salt getting to us. That we can get now from understanding salt in a different way. So this line from Vayikra describes how salt is on every single sacrifice that we do. And it says, V'chol korban minchatcha b'melach tinlach, v'lo tashbid melach brit Elohecha, me'al minchatecha, al kol korbancha takriv melach. You shall season on every offering of meal with salt. You will not omit from your meal offering the salt of your covenant with God. With all of your offerings, you must offer salt. Okay, seems important that you need salt, an important part of the recipe. But the phraseology of melach brit, and then in Bamidbar, where it comes up again in the context of korbanot, it says brit melach, is an interesting way to explain it. Like, why is there a covenant involved when thinking about this sacrifice, and what does it have to do when thinking about salt? Like, what is the connection between covenant and salt? So we see a few different understandings of what that could mean. Here from Masechet Brachot, we have a metaphorical understanding that is, and this is the statement of Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. As Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said, the word covenant is used with regard to salt, and the word covenant is used with regard to afflictions. So they're noticing that the term brit is used in the context of these two things. So there must be something connected about them. The word covenant is used with regard to salt, as it is written. The salt of the covenant with your God should not be excluded from your meal offering. With all your sacrifices, you must offer salt. That's what we read. And the word covenant is used in regard to afflictions, as it's written. These are the words of the covenant from Devarim. Just as the covenant mentioned with regard to salt, the salt sweetens the taste of the meat and renders it edible, so too, in the covenant mentioned with regard to suffering, the suffering cleanses a person's transgressions, purifying him for a more sublime existence. So here we have this metaphorical understanding, which is that just as salt on a scientific level, if there are foodies or food chemists here in the room, maybe they would be able to speak to this experience better. When we salt meat, it makes it more edible and sweetened. We can then understand that suffering is what makes a person more driven to then want to do some kind of tshuva or repentance, reach out to God and do better. So this metaphor is a little bit difficult because a justification of any kind of pain or suffering is theologically difficult and may not speak to us in the 21st century. But at least what hopefully we can appreciate, even if the outcome of the metaphor is somewhat problematic, in thinking about how punishment is experienced and pain is experienced, is that there's some kind of connection of salt being a metaphor for cleansing or for purifying. And that connection is made here. Another example of it in the power of preservation is from the Sifrei, on Bamidbar. And the explanation there of covenant of salt is scripture forged a covenant with Aaron, with something, with salt, which preserves and which furthermore preserves other things. So why did it say that every single sacrifice needs to have salt? Well, because salt preserves, and we want the kahuna, the priesthood, to preserve us or be preserved in connection with God as being the chosen group to do sacrifices. So it's also like a nice example of the metaphor. Salt preserves, and we want to feel preserved and connected to God. Another example here from Vayikra Rabbah talks about another example of that kind of covenant. You granted priesthood to Aaron forever in what we said, an everlasting covenant of salt. You granted kingdom to David forever, as it stated, do you not know that the Lord God of Israel gave kingship over Israel to David forever? You granted holiness to Israel forever, as it stated, you shall be holy. So we're looking at different examples of where salt represents the eternal. One we just saw with Aharon. Here's this example about King David, where the example from Divrei Hayamim actually talks about how they also made a covenant in salt. It was a very like political back and forth in Divrei Hayamim, and it actually says that they used salt in order to represent that political covenant, which is a kind of funny image, but is really taking that metaphor to home. And therefore, when we see in the context of sacrifice and with kingship, it also represents that God wants us to be with God forever, and through holiness, and salt represents all of those things.
Do you think that the word mamlacha is a verbal play with the word melech?
The terms are different because melech, like a king, is with a chaf, but then salt, melech, is with a chet. However, it does sound similar, so that does seem to invoke, at least it sounds similar, but I don't know if there's like an official, doesn't seem to me there be an official connection, but I do think it's a very good topical connection, and works really well with this midrash. So here's some examples of that we just saw about salt as preserving. This just, I think, like adds an extra layer to the significance of salt and what it could do. Which maybe is then why, thinking all the way back to my Machronim, like why would we be so concerned about salt or think it has so much power in general? Well, here's an example of how powerful salt can be. Salt represents like the eternity of both like connection with us, with God, the way of preserving, literally preserving meat or other things, and also representation of like of political connections. So salt is important. It's not just your typical kind of condiment that you'd use. Salt has the ability to represent really powerful things and therefore have a huge significance. So there's one way of seeing salt in a different way. I think also salt, and we're beginning to see this, can represent a kind of balance and duality. Like salt has the ability to preserve things, but also be dangerous. Like we saw that like salt can be the thing that destroys stone or that turns Lot's wife into a pillar of salt and then not alive anymore. And also salt is a thing that then can represent all of these beautiful connections and preserve. So that's just interesting. Like salt seems to represent many things. And we have more understandings here of what that means of salt doing that, but then just adds even more significance to what salt could be. So here we have a really beautiful iteration of back to that example of the Brit Melech from Rabbeinu Bachya, who is from the 1200s in Spain, and he says the following: a midrashic approach tinged with Kabbalah. God had concluded a covenant with the waters in the lower regions of the universe. At the same time, these waters were separated from the upper waters, and that on Sukkot, some of these waters laced with salt would be used as a libation on God's altar. This is confirmed by Breishis Rabbah, according to which the lower waters were called crying waters, as they accepted the separation from the upper waters only after shedding salty tears. So here's a really beautiful midrashic story that is being shared with us, which is that on day two of creation, we have the articulation of there being the creation with the rakia, a division between the water and sea below, and then the water, which really is like evaporated into the sky that leads to rain or to clouds. And there was a sense of sadness that some of the water and then the salt also, right, because salt is in the sea, couldn't go with the water that reached above, that there was this rakia, this division between the two. So there was a sadness and there was crying, right? When we cry, there is salt in the tears. And so the idea is that God says, no problem. I know it's like really sweet that you like really want to be together, these waters. And you will have the opportunity to be together once again, which is on Sukkot. There will be libations, and libations are sacrifices where there's water poured, but sacrifices are meant to then go up to God. The understanding too, if you were looking in Bereishit Rabbah itself, is that like the salt that is used on every single sacrifice is then returning back to its original source up above, or with its original partner up above. And so the idea is that like the salt being there is a representation of the return and like a unity between the sky and the sea, which is a really beautiful image. I think it's like a very powerful midrash. It's a really powerful story, and salt is really integral in that, in making that connection. The salt being the tears and the sea below that wants to unify with the above, and then appearing in the form of sacrifices that then lead to going up and above. That's their ability to return together. So that's like a really nice image of what salt can be. And then we have a different part of Rabbeinu Bachya, which is the Kabbalistic approach. A Kabbalistic approach. Salt contains two forces which are opposites of one another. They are fire and water. The power of warmth, i.e., the sun, which dries out the water, making the salt congeal and solidify. I suppose the meaning is that through the heat of the sun, which causes such water as the waters of the Dead Sea to evaporate, salt is isolated and becomes identifiable. In other words, heat or fire, the opposite of water, releases the power of the salt in the water. Seeing that water and fire are the two elements which ensure the existence and continuity of the universe, salt combines these two elements in a certain form. It is the catalyst, so to speak, for water and fire to interact. And this is the reason why the Torah writes it that way. So we saw this really beautiful midrashic understanding of salt being the thing that will unify the sea and the sky. Now we have it go even one step further, which is that salt represents the unification of opposing elements, which are the fire and the water. By heat drying up water and then having salt be there. Salt then gets isolated, but then also there's salt in salt water, and so yet it can be both. You can go back and forth. So we see here from Rabbeinu Bachya this beginning of this articulation that salt can do so much, and it can even have represent opposing things, and yet it goes together, and it's powerful that it goes together. Another interesting example of where Melastomit salt comes in, and also it represents a kind of duality, is from the recipe of the creation of the blending of incense of Pitoma Ketoret. Maybe you'd be familiar with this from after saying Ein Kelohenu on Shabbat day. We have from Crito, this passage that gives us a bit of the recipe book of how the Ketoret was made. So we have lots of different interesting ingredients: balm, frankincense, different measurements, myrrh, saffron. But then in the middle we have sodomite salt is brought in a volume of quarter kav, and that's just like written there that that's one of the ingredients, which is really interesting considering what we just said before, is that salt that comes from stone could be so dangerous that it could blind your eyes. And also maybe represents this metaphorical blindness. And yet it is in the recipe for the incense that is used in the temple that is supposed to bring us closer to God. It is what is used in order to is used when giving sacrifices, and it's supposed to be some kind of spiritual elevation. And we're using something that comes from a source that is potentially so morally problematic as part of the recipe. And that's really interesting, and another example of the sense of duality that this Melastomit can come from such an evil place, and yet it is a recipe that is used for something that is in the temple that's supposed to get us closer to God. Salt is somehow both, even Melastomit is somehow both. And that then shows us again the power of salt, and that it's something that should be significant. A little bit of a pop culture reference to show again this duality of salt. And we even saw this a bit before in the Rabbeinu Bachya. This is from Samit Nosrat. She is a very famous cook, a chef, and she has a really amazing cookbook called Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, where she talks about like the scientific elements that help make food really good. And her argument is that you don't need to be particularly fancy in order for food to be good. You just need to know how to use these four elements really well. And the way she explains salt is this: though we typically turn to sugar to balance out bitter flavors in a sauce or soup, it turns out that salt masks bitterness much more effectively than sugar. See for yourself with a little tonic water, Campari, or grapefruit juice, all of which are both bitter and sweet. Taste a spoonful, then add a pinch of salt and taste again. You'll be surprised how much by how much bitterness subsides. So great, we have yet another example in like regular everyday life, without even thinking about the potential scientific reality if there's malastomide or not, of how salt does these things. Salt, even though it is a really intense savory flavor and maybe even sometimes bitter, has the opportunity to sweeten. It is possible to do both with salt, and so this shows the power of salt as an element. Okay, that was a lot of information. Does anyone have any points or questions to share before we see how to connect it back once again to our parsha?
Right. I'd like to say something about the Sodomi salt.
Sure.
I would see it more as a not some kind of representation of the immorality, or you know, the evil of Sodom, because that's not where it comes from. It comes from heaven. This is the gafrit that was sent down by God from heaven. So it really is not something that is whole. It's almost something kodesh itself. So putting it on the mizbeach makes a whole lot of sense, because it's not natural. It's, you know, it's not, you don't mine it. It's the gafrit and the melach that came, that it's divine. So there's a, you know, going along with the whole story. So although it's not mined out, even if it were mined from that area, it's the stuff that came down from heaven. So it has an element of kedusha to it, I would think.
Okay, that's really beautiful, that even though it's so destructive and it's what's used in order to destroy Sodom and Amorah, it ultimately like came from God to begin with. So we see that again, this like sense of opposing, like there's good and bad above and below, all happening within salt. Yeah, that's really beautiful. Anyone else have anything they want to share?
Melach salt also kashers the meat.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you just said that because it was related to destruction, but the idea of this destruction was actually to improve the world and not to do the opposite. Because Sodom and Gomorrah, obviously, they did not help the world, planet, and everything else. So...
Yes, I didn't include this in this presentation, but in the Guide for the Perplexed in Mor Nevuchim, Maimonides talks about where salting meat comes from in order to make sure that it is kosher. And he says, as he often does in the Guide for the Perplexed, he'll talk about what the pagan ritual is and how we are trying to like act in reactionariness to the pagan ritual. So he says within the pagan ritual that there was a concern of having salt in meat, because salt used to take blood out of the meat. That's how we kosher. And they saw that as blood sucking the life force out of a thing, blood being the representation of the life force. And that they saw that as problematic. I saw this superstitious. How could salt take the thing that is life-sustaining? So we will not salt our meat. And then Maimonides says, but we don't believe in that kind of superstition, so we don't care. So that actually is one of the sources for why we will then salt meat, is that we want to show that we understand the life source is not blood, it's God. So we don't really care about what the pagan concern might be. And so it's seen as a direct, almost reactionary consequence to that, which I think picks up a bit on what you're saying. Like in koshering and making meat available and edible to us, we need to use salt, even though paradoxically it's taking blood, which we understand just naturalistically is necessary in order to survive. And yet we need it in order to make the food accessible to us. So yes, thank you. Thanks for the reminder to bring that up. Okay. Any last thoughts? Otherwise, I think we'll try and see how it connects to our parsha. Okay. So, what we just discussed is how salt could be significant. First, we also all the way saw back to mayim achronim being something that was understood to be a scientific necessity, and how that might not necessarily be true anymore. But yet there's a lot of other powerful things to think about when thinking about salt. Yet we haven't actually figured out a way to talk about how does that then make our understanding of mayim achronim more meaningful, and how can we connect it back to our parsha then? So I want to go back to thinking about Lot's wife and what happened to her and why it was salt. That is what occurred to her, right? We knew before that Lot was told by the angels that he wasn't allowed to look back. We discussed why it would be not so great to look back, that it was a concern that it almost would represent a kind of moral wavering back and forth about wanting to leave or not wanting to leave. That if Lot and his family felt very clearly detached from a place that was as evil as Sodom, they wouldn't have to look back and question their decision. And if they looked back, that seems to suggest that maybe they did feel more attached to a morally depraved place. But, okay, so Lot's wife does look back, which is the bad thing. But why does she turn then into a pillar of salt? We saw that there's sulfur that falls on Sodom and Amorah, and that is connected to the element of salt, but it still feels kind of strange. It doesn't use the term gafrit, which is the term that's used for the sulfur that falls down on Sodom and Amorah, to talk about her. It talks about Melah. So why is that what happens to her? And Rashi provides in a midrashic fashion of midah keneged midah, kind of like a tit for tat, that it must be that the punishment that she received is because an action of an action that she did previously. And that's what Rashi provides for us here. And Rashi says, "B'melech chata'a u'b'melech laketa." Amar la, "Tni me'at melech le'orchim halalu." Amra lo, "Afa minhag hara hazeh ata ba'la anhig b'makom hazeh." So what Rashi says is, okay, in salt she sinned, and therefore in salt she was punished and taken away from us. What does it mean that she sinned with salt? Is that we go back to all the way to the scene at the beginning of chapter 19, where Lot is welcoming the guests, the angels, into his home. We also need to remember that this comes the chapter after Avraham invites angels into his home, and we learn about the power of hachnasat orchim, of welcoming guests, which becomes so important in the Jewish tradition and becomes a value for us in opening our own homes to other people. We see the contrast that Lot is trying to do the same within Sodom and Amorah, but realizes that that's not actually what the people of Sodom and Amorah do. They're so morally depraved that they don't like when strangers come in, or are concerned when strangers appear or come to people's homes. And it seems like Lot's wife is also of that mentality. What Lot says, in order to be a good guest, almost like Avraham and Sarah prepared such amazing food, an amazing feast for the angels, he says, let's make sure that there's some salt given to these strangers, right? You don't need salt, but salt is like a beautiful way to add garnish to a meal. And yet Lot's wife says, why would you introduce this bad custom also in our city? Meaning she doesn't want to give them salt, which is interesting, right? Like, what does it mean that it's a bad custom? Minhag hara. But it seems to be that even just pampering the guests a little bit and showing that they are special with salt, that was something that was so upsetting to Lot's wife. Why would you do that to our guests? Like, why would you bring that here? Why couldn't you have left that with Avraham and his family and how they do things? Why are you bringing it to Sodom? Which shows that she, by not being as hospitable as she could have been, that is then the response to how then she's going to get punished. That seems kind of extreme. I think we've all had experiences in our lives where we haven't felt the most on as hosts to our guests. Why would this be the action that is so morally apprehensible that it turns her into a pillar of salt? And for this, we have to go to the Mishnah, to Pirkei Avot, where we learn a little bit more about what that kind of mentality, that minhag ha-ra, being understood as ra, bad in Sodom, represents. And so it says, Arba midot ba'adam. There are four types of character in human being. One is ha'omer sheli sheli v'shelcha shelcha. Zo mida benonit. So, okay, four kinds of character. One is, okay, this stuff is mine and that stuff is yours. That is just a regular kind of a way to live, which I think a lot of us can understand. I'm someone who lives in an apartment with roommates, and so understanding my room is theirs, is mine, and their room is theirs, and we're not going to overlap is pretty normal. However, at the end it says, V'yeshomrim midat Sodom. But some people say, actually, that might be commonplace, but actually that would be like the mentality of Sodom. So we'll circle back to that in a second. Just we'll finish here. Shali shalcha v'shalcha shali am ha'aret. Someone who says, what is mine is yours and what yours is mine, that is what an unlearned person would say. Shali shalcha v'shalcha shalach. Is a chassid, someone who says what is mine is yours and what is yours is truly pious, right? Because they're basically giving up everything for the other person. Shali shali v'shalcha shali rasha. And if someone says, okay, this stuff is mine and whatever is yours is mine, so that is someone who doesn't have good midot, is not a good person. Okay, So that provides at least like the different potentials for how we understand ourselves in relation to others. But this first one, to go back to, the one that's the most commonplace, the most typical of saying, this is mine under my jurisdiction, and that is yours under your jurisdiction, that is commonplace, and yet that is the midah of stone. Stone, which is such a morally depraved place, this is how they acted. And the Midrash that was quoted by Rashi actually expands more beyond Lot's wife not giving the salt, that she actually drew a line in the room when Lot and the guests were there, and she said, that part of the room is yours, this part of the room is mine, which is exactly that articulation that we see here, but it feels incredibly wrong in the Midrashic understanding. It doesn't feel like the right way to be with other people. It feels like this sense of not understanding how to be a cohesive group together that supports each other. And so even though it was just merely salt that Lot's wife didn't want to give, it seems to be representative of this larger stone mentality of not wanting to share and support one another. And that is what makes it so morally depraved of her to not do that. And so that is what then gets her to be in that punishment. The last source here, and this will be the way we kind of wrap up everything, is one more source about Mayim Achorim that we did not talk about, that kind of, I think, connects all the dots together that we've seen today about Mayim Achorim potentially being a safety concern, but also representing like a sense of moral blindness concern, seeing how salt can represent so many powerful things, the good and the bad. So we're going to see this source here from the Gemara that's going to hopefully wrap this up for us. Okay, this is from Masechet Brachot. Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, Ana la zilai ve la zivai ve la zuhamai yadana, ela matnita yadana. Okay, so it doesn't know these people, zilai, zivai, zuhamai, but, or these statements. But now I do know a breita. What is this breita that Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak knows? Demar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav ve amrila ve matnita tana. That's the breita. Here it comes. It's a breakdown of a pasuk from Vayikra. The pasuk is Vehit Kadish Tem, Vitem Kedoshim, Ki Kadosh Ani Adonai Elohechem. You should be holy, or you should sanctify yourselves, and you should be holy, because I am holy, I, the Lord your God. Okay, that's a lot of repetitive words, and so since the Torah does not waste words, the Torah lo mevazvezet milim, it must be coming to teach us different things. So how do we see how this breita breaks it down? Okay, this first statement about sanctifying yourself, that's talking about doing nitzilat yadayim before doing hamotzi, before eating bread. We know that kind of washing hands. That's what we're all familiar with. Then, vitem kiroshim, ilumayim achronim, that type of sanctifying yourself is talking about mayim achronim, which is what we've been talking about. Ki kadosh, because I am holy, or God is holy. That is referring to oil in which we anoint. Ani Adonai Elohechem, that is talking about blessings, but specifically Birkat HaMazon. So this pasuk, which just seems to be about sanctification, 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 actually is coming to articulate different parts of the meal, including Mayim Achronim. So when we think about the reasons for why Mayim Achronim exists, we have the technical safety concern, but we also have this one, that it is a way to be kadosh and to be holy. What does that actually mean? People might be familiar with the Ramban on Kiddushim Tiyu in Vayikra. The Ramban says about Kiddushim Tiyu, it's somewhat of a paradoxical kind of commandment. Isn't all of Torah and commandments supposed to make us holy? How do we have a separate other kind of mitzvah that tells us to be holy? What it's telling us is that even when halacha tells us to do one thing, but we could go above and beyond, we should go above and beyond. Lifnei Mishirat Hadin, going above and beyond the law, that too is built in within our system. That somehow, I think the fancy term for it legally is supererogatory, that when you have built into the clause of a legal system to go beyond the legal system, it somehow ensures that it still stays within the legal system and that it's credible. And that's what Kiddushim Tiyu is. It makes sure that we are not a Naval B'Yeshut HaTorah, that even though God never commands us to put salt on the table or to be kind hosts, that it's the right thing to do, and therefore it is important and God wants you to do it. And so that is what Mayim Achronim then comes to represent. Mayim Achronim comes to represent doing those kinds of above and beyond kind of mitzvot, or not mitzvot even, sorry, the above and beyond actions to help make more life more beautiful, right? You also have the articulation of the shemen here, like an oil. Like that's not something that's necessary, but something that beautifies and enhances meals. But that's also such an important part of being a part of the of a Jewish community, of even thinking halachically. And that is not what Stone was doing. That's not what the community of Stone was doing. They were at this commonplace kind of way of thinking. This is yours, and this is what is mine is mine, and what yours is yours. That's not really the right way to be with each other, or to be even in covenant with each other. And ultimately, for Lot's wife, that's like her downfall is not understanding how significant that those kinds of actions are. And ultimately, Stone's downfall is also because they do not realize that those kinds of maybe even little or minuscule actions and supporting each other is what is so integral in building a community together. So to tie everything we said back together, we just saw that there's a halacha called Mayim Achronim, that you do this kind of washing after, actually I'll turn off the sharing now. We have this mitzvah, of doing Mayim Achronim after you eat, but as you're getting ready to bench. It seems like something that doesn't feel so necessary anymore in a modern world where medically we don't really have the concern of melech stomit getting in our eyes and blinding us. But there's a lot of beautiful valences of what the salt, the melech stomit, could be, that even if it doesn't exist on a technical, scientific level, there are many ways in which our lives in which we can be morally blinded to things around us. We saw that Lot himself was morally blinded in being allured to a place like Sodom and Gomorrah to live, but also salt in its power and valence of representing so many powerful things, whether it be connection or brit with us and God, or even a sense of like political connection between other people, the understanding that it could be something that is life-sustaining or harming, that salt representing those things, and then the last part about the salt on the table, that you don't have to do the salt. You don't have to be with other people this way and make life beautiful in this way, or see it as with a particularly meaningful valence. But yet doing Mayim Achronim in the spirit of the Kiddushim to you, of sanctification, means that we are called to look at the world that way. That being in the halakhic world, or the world of Torah, requires us to go above and beyond. And so even when something like Mayim Achronim doesn't really feel relevant today on a medical level, it still could teach us a lot about what it means to go above and beyond. And that even though it will not blind us in a physical sense, there are many things in the world that blind us from helping each other, or even just supporting each other, not in a necessary way, but even the ways that could be beautiful, like sanctifying the salt, the bread on the table with salt, and just making things be beautiful and sweet for each other. And so I myself still don't do my macaroni, but this is not halacha l'maaseh here, but hopefully in seeing that it is a halacha that people still do, some people have continuously been doing, and that it could represent more than just a medical concern, but also be a call for us to do better and strive above and beyond more than what Stom or Lot's wife did. Hopefully that can be a meaningful takeaway for us even now, and a different way to be thinking about Parsha Vayera in a world where the Torah has not been given yet in Parsha Vayera, that there still could be something that's so significant and halachically significant, I think is pretty special.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, comments?
Wouldn't you say that Mayim Achronim was a minhag rather than a halacha?
From what I saw, the terminology was that it's a chovah, which means that it's necessary, which puts it back into like the medical category. I don't think, let's say, like we were talking before about fish and meat not going together, I don't think that's a minhag categorically. I think it's also in the scientific realm. I don't believe that it's in the minhag category from what I saw. I could double check, but I don't think that is how it is technically categorized.
What I always find interesting, if you ever go to where people do the Mayim Achronim, first of all, you mentioned in the beginning, I'm not sure, like Mayim Achronim, when you do it properly, you do it like not like a drop of water, they take like a, supposed to be washing your hands, but okay, so nobody does that. That's not true. Nobody, very few people do that. But even when they pass around, I always notice, and I've never understood, the women never do it. Other people notice it? Men do it, and it goes, she passes it to the next one. I don't understand. I'm just, find that fascinating. And
I in my research that I saw, Rabbi Akiva Eiger writes about how women are absolutely obligated, in the sense of, like, we're back to this point, like,
there should be no difference, of course.
it's a scientific issue. It applies to women as well. The other thing that I will say that was just interesting on a halachic level is that when you look at the Shulchan Aruch about the Siman, all about Mayim Achronim, and I believe many Sfarnim still, like, as in we have stopped doing it, but it has continuously been done. I know that Yekki Ashkenazi Jews stopped doing it the moment that it was understood to be only a scientific, from a scientific level, it wasn't relevant. But the Siman in the Shulchan Aruch goes through a lot of details about what kind of water and how much water you need. That's very different than Nitilat Yadayim. Nitilat Yadayim, there's a required measurement that's needed in order for it to be Yotze. Also, that the water wasn't exposed to other things, or that animals hadn't drunk from it. And you don't need that in Mayim Achronim. So it does seem to be not exactly the same on a halachic level. Like we saw, that there's a bracha, you'd say, for Nitilat Yadayim, and it's coming to do something else, and to matir eating. Yeah, to matir eating the bread, which is also, like, still, it represents what the Kohanim used to do in a Tuman Tahara world that doesn't exist today. But even then, it's still seen as a commandment and not as a scientific concern the same way Mayim Achronim is, and therefore, yeah, it doesn't have the same kind of stringency. And yet women didn't do it, because I guess people didn't realize where it comes from.
I
So
mean, you have a lot of things, people didn't do. But also, I still don't think it means one or two drops. Like, and the people who I know who are machmir on my machmirim do like in the Tila Shona. They do they wash their whole hands. Anyways, but okay, thank you very much. Any other comments, questions? I hope your parents got much nachas. I see they're both here, so very nice. And thank you, Sophia. And tomorrow morning, of course, my regular shiur on the Siddur at 9:15 in the morning. Next Monday, it's sort of complimentary. Yosef Lindell is starting a new series. It's always very interesting on who wrote the Siddur. I'm going to put the registration link in the chat box. And that's going to be a four-part series, the sort of the history, the shiur. So that's Monday at 1 p.m., starting a four-week series. And in addition to all, Rabbi Liebtag, of course, will kick off our week as usual at 11:15. And invite a friend. Those who live in Toronto, okay, I guess that's Rabbi Slifkin, of course, is here this weekend, and we'll be hosting him on Saturday night. You do have to register. We haven't announced this new world that we live in. We don't announce the location. I know it's nuts, but that's how it works. So, anyways, if you want to register, this is live. This is not on Zoom. This is a live program. You have to come with your body and soul. So, but that's it in Toronto Saturday night. You can go to the website and register. Okay, I think that's it for now. And I want to wish everybody Shabbat Shalom. Be well. Hope to see you soon and invite a friend. And thank you, Sophia. And all the best.
Thank you. And Shabbat Shalom, Rabbi.
Shabbat Shalom.
Bye-bye.
That
Thank you,
was very good.
Sophia.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nice seeing you, Rabbi Jay. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.